Rory Lawton joins me from Berlin, Germany this week to discuss the German beer purity laws. This is Beer Smith Podcast number 141.
This is the Beer Smith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 141, and it's late January 2017. This week, Rory Lawton joins me from Berlin to take on the controversial subject of efforts to amend the 500-year-old German beer purity law. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're running an amazing deal right now, only $19.99 for a year-long subscription or $17.99 for the digital edition. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. You can read my new column called Ask the Experts there. Take advantage of their special deal now at beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. The interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your phone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download your recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and set up updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today, another innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And also Beersmith Software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers. It lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial today from Beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Rory Lawton, coming to us from Berlin, Germany. Rory is a writer in Berlin who has actually been campaigning with a small number of German beer brewers to challenge the status of Rhein-Heinz-Gebot, or the beer purity law. He's also working to promote the rediscovery of Germans' historical beer culture. So today we're going to have a discussion about the law, its history, and implications for German brewing. Rory, it is great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Brad. It's an honor to be here. I'm delighted to be able to talk about it here. So from Germany, from ground zero. Interesting to have this discussion with you and give my own perspective and see how things are in Germany at the moment.
So you're in Berlin at the moment. I'm trying to think. It's about what a 5-6 hour difference, I guess. Something like that.
It's a 6 hour difference. Yeah, it's the late afternoon here at the moment. I'm originally from Dublin, Ireland, but I've been living in Berlin for over 5 years now. And have been working within the industry on and off for the last 4 years or so. So seeing the new craft beer breweries emerge, also talked to the larger breweries and being involved in the different beer festivals here, done beer tastings and founded the Berlin Homebrewing Competition. So I've been involved in all aspects of the beer culture here in Germany.
And most importantly, you're a home brewer, right?
Most importantly, I'm a home brewer and have some useful software to help me out. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to have you here. And I think the German purity law, which many of us here in the U.S. are familiar with, celebrated its 500th anniversary in 2016. So it goes back to 1516. I was wondering if you could maybe discuss a little bit of the history around the original declaration, which was in 1516, and how it came about.
Sure. So there's a few things that we're going to have to untangle in the course of this conversation. But yes, starting with the original 1516 declaration, there was a declaration on the 23rd of April, 1516, in a Bavarian city called Ingolstadt. And remember at the time that Bavaria was a much smaller country. Much smaller than the Bavarian state is today in Germany. But there was a decree on the 23rd of April, 1516, where the Duke William IV and his brother Ludwig X decreed in a Bavarian state regulation that beer brewed in the summer and winter should be charged a certain amount for different kinds of beer. And then as an aside, it was mentioned that only water, barley, and hops should be used in the brewing of beer. So historically, there was a document signed on the 23rd of April. So this 500-year anniversary does tie into that. The Brewers Association in Germany chose that because it was the decree that probably had the largest lasting impact There were other decrees which we can talk about earlier, but the one from 1516 is the one that, you know, had a certain amount of status over the coming centuries.
And just to clarify, what did the original decree actually say?
So the original decree was a tax law. It stated, it was largely about, you can find it online, and there's an English translation available as well. It stated the different prices that needed to be charged for different kinds of beer, setting an upper limit on them. And it restricted brewing to water, barley, and hops. And what's interesting there is that there was no mention of malt and no mention of yeast at the time. Now, it was understood that yeast was important for brewing. It wasn't understood as a fungus at the time. But there had been discussions between bakers and brewers about the role of yeast and who was responsible for paying for it. So I think we can let that one go aside. But what's more interesting is that it declared that barley should be used for beer. And the reason that barley was mentioned was that at the time, you know, food wasn't as plentiful as it is today. And wheat and rye were very useful for baking bread, but barley was actually not so useful for baking. But barley is excellent for brewing beer with. So that's why barley was stipulated. And the decree was really to keep wheat out of the breweries. And then the control of taxes on barley for brewing and wheat for baking could be separately controlled.
Which is kind of ironic because now Bavaria is very well known for their wheat beer, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that is correct. But wheat beer has had its own interesting history, which has often been forgotten. But I think we can get onto that particular aspect later. There was at the time, there was a habit of putting other things into the beer. So it's not that this was 100% a tax law. If you look at the document, you'll see its purpose is quite clear. But at the time, there were other ingredients put in to bitter the beer. Beer was being made cheaper and cheaper. The brewers at the time, it was a lot more work than it is today to make the beers. So, you know, different spices could be used. Bittering ingredients other than hops could be used. Some of these were deemed to be poisonous. So there were food safety concerns at the time, but that wasn't the basis for this decree. If you look at the original text, it's quite clearly a tax law.
Interesting. So this thing's now taken on somewhat of a mythical status, of course. Can you tell us about some of the true history versus some of the myths surrounding it, actually?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the reason we're having this conversation, is that the myths have almost taken over from the realities, from the facts that are readily available. And it's changed so often in the last 500 years that, you know, we really need to re-examine what's being said and what was originally said. So the myth that's often repeated and that I've heard a lot in the last year, so in 2016 was the 500-year anniversary, is that something like this. The Reinheitsgebot from 1516 is the first and longest continuous consumer protection law that guarantees the quality of German beer. And you'll see this over and over on websites and in leaflets and in the celebrations that took place around the 23rd of April 2016. And I want to unpack this a little bit because almost every single aspect of this statement is untrue. So the Reinheitsgebot itself, so the purity law would be the English translation, isn't really from 1516 at all, but is a more modern term that was only introduced formally in 1918. So Reinheitsgebot, the word, this is a phrase that's often used to talk about German brewing heritage, to talk about the different restrictions, and to also talk about the modern German tax laws. And we need to be very careful when we talk about Reinheitsgebot, what are we actually referring to? And I often say that this is a game of switcheroo that's played. So the defenders of the Reinheitsgebot will often use it to defend exactly what they're looking to defend. And then, you know, to talk about the German beer culture as if the Reinheitsgebot is responsible for it. But Reinheitsgebot itself, the word didn't come into German practice until 1918 when it was first formally documented. And has been used. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Go ahead. Oh, no. I was just asking, is that the same time that the law became German? Was applied Germany-wide, or was it done? Because I know originally exactly. It was only Bavaria, right?
Around the same time. Originally Bavaria, and then, you know, Bavaria became part of the German kingdom in 1871. But this law applied to all of Germany in 1906. But at the time, it was a tax law. But in 1918, it was documented in the Bavarian parliament that advertising is becoming more and more important for the brewing industry, and that something like the Reinheitsgebot, therefore, it would make sense to use an expression like this. So that's the first thing, that the word itself is important, that we clarify what we mean when we talk about the purity law, Reinheitsgebot.
And what does the word mean if I was translating it to English?
So Reinheit would mean purity, and Gebot is a law. So it actually, the technical translation would be the purity law.
Makes sense. So
what's often said, that this is the first and continuously running consumer protection law. It certainly wasn't the first, and this is known. For example, in 1487 in Munich, there was a separate purity law signed by Duke Albrecht IV. Before then, there was another one, the Statuta Taberna in Weißensee from 1434, which was also restricting what brewers could do in the mash tun. So it's certainly not the first law of its kind, but it did have widespread impact and then later widespread appeal. So 1516 is a nice marketing term. And to use the law as it applied to all of Bavaria, but it certainly wasn't the first. The next part I wanted to tackle is that it was continuous. It wasn't continuous at all. It was often ignored in the last 500 years. And, brewers would use other grains. In terms of filtration techniques, they were using isinglass even in Bavaria as late as the late 19th century. So it wasn't enforced. It was enforced only at different points. And it certainly wasn't continuous. It wasn't a consumer protection law at all. The price of the beer was fixed, and the brewers were told what they could put in their mash tuns, but it had nothing to do with consumers. And in fact, it doesn't even mention beer quality at all. At the time, there would have been a lot of spoilage. This was before the time of, single yeast strains being isolated, which didn't happen until the 19th century. So beer would have had varying quality at the time. This was known and continued to have varying quality for the next 500 years or 400 years. But there was certainly no mention of spoiled beer or what to do with spoiled beer. And the original statement doesn't mention yeast or malt. So in that sense, the law itself has changed. So wheat had been added later, and then there were further restrictions about top fermenting and bottom fermenting yeast that were introduced over the next century. So in terms of continuity, there's no continuity there at all.
Yeah, I had to. Go ahead.
No, so just to finalize then, in terms of this marketing gimmick that's used, that this is a continuous consumer protection law, that kind of falls flat on its face, no matter how you look at it.
Yeah, I had Randy Mosher on last year talking about beer history, and he would, basically, if you pull apart the myth behind almost every single beer style we can name, history is messy. It doesn't always follow the myth, if you will. Almost all the styles that we talk about today have a sort of a mythical stat, mythical history, and then when you start actually pulling it apart, it becomes a little more complicated than that.
But that's what makes this discussion really interesting. What's happened in the last 4 years, particularly with the craft breweries from the US and this rediscovery of these beer styles, I think it's an interesting conversation. And I think it's good that we don't get everything perfectly right the first time, but at least there's an interest in different beer styles. And if you look at how the myth of the IPA has changed in the last 10, 15 years, I think it's interesting. It gives us something to talk about. But as long as we respect the facts when we find them, and we look for original documentation when we find them, and then we make adjustments to, example, the BJ JCP guidelines, I think, are a very useful document. I challenge some details in that, particularly with the home brewers and, judging particular beer styles, where maybe American brewers have been overzealous in their interpretation of history. But as long as we're open to correction, then this is all useful. We can have fun in the meantime. We can, rediscover beers and then try and fine-tune their historical accuracy as well. But we need to be both passionate and respectful for facts when they appear, even if they're inconvenient.
Yeah, we had we were talking about Scottish ales a short time ago as well, and same thing. Almost all the Scottish history that you talk about is not quite what you think it is. It turns out there was all kinds of beers brewed in Scotland, of course. That's probably true in Germany as well. So the purity law evolved quite a bit over time. You covered a lot of that, but what does it actually look like today? What can you use? What can't you use? How does it apply?
Right. So the beer law as it applies today is really as the legal framework that's in place in Germany is the Biersteuergesetz. So that's the beer tax law. from 1993. And that has changed. There were a few points in time when the beer law needed to be updated. So from 1906, the formal restriction applied to all of Germany. In 1918, you had the first use of the term Reinheitsgebot. The first Biersteuergesetz, so beer tax law, was from 1923. And there was another change in 1952. But the most recent one in place is the Biersteuergesetz from 1993. And the old rules from before, so the restrictions on what could and couldn't be put in the mash tun, so in terms of ingredients and additives, was carried over as the Vorläufiges Biergesetz. So the new beer tax law from 1993 dictates all aspects of brewing, and in terms of the ingredients and additives, that's dictated by the Vorläufiges Biergesetz. And what that says, it's very, very tightly restricted for bottom fermenting beers. So Germans very protective of their lager beer styles, and is a little bit more permissive for top fermenting beer styles. And what it says is basically that only malted barley, water, hops, and yeast can be used for bottom fermented beers. But for top fermented beers, you can add other malted grains, and you can add sugars, which isn't often talked about because, you know, German brewers rarely use top fermenting yeast for anything other than wheat beer. There are additional ingredients that can be used for top fermenting beers.
So now, you could make potentially an ale with sugar or other ingredients, right?
Yes, you can. You can, yes. So again, people talk about the Reinheitsgebot, and really they're talking about the four ingredients. Well, the three ingredients as listed in 1516, but then you allow liberties, you know, for yeast. And they're really talking about the German beer culture when they talk about it most often. They don't talk about what is permissible for top fermented beer styles. What's interesting, and when we get into debate with the German brewers, is that no additional ingredients are allowed as part of brewing. But that modern techniques do allow for other additives, clearing agents, to be used as long as these can be taken out again and have no noticeable impact on the flavor or appearance of the beer.
Interesting. So, I mean, you can potentially use things like filtering, I guess.
That's correct.
And you can also use finings, I guess. Most finings, I would think, right?
So this is what's open to debate. I mean, the German brewing industry has set itself up where PVPP is used. And, you know, most brewers will have no problem with PVPP, but it just goes against the spirit of the 1516 ruling in terms of that it's a modern filtration agent. It's definitely, you know, artificial.
That's a plastic, right, isn't it?
That's a plastic that's put into the beer and then refilled.
Like polyclar would be probably what homebrewers are familiar with. Polyclar is the same as PVPP, I believe.
Exactly. But if you were to take something like Eger, so Irish Moss, or if you were to take something like Isinglass, German brewers don't use these because these would be seen as chemical filtration agents, and it's up to debate whether they could be defended as purely mechanical filtration or physical filtration, and if they would come out as readily as PVPP. Now, there are studies that have been done on PVPP that show that it's not entirely filtered out. Of course, it depends on the mechanical filtration techniques that you use or how long you allow it to clear. But in studies on recently on 14 commercially brewed Pilsner beers in Germany, traces of physical filtration were found in the beer, and this caused a little bit of a stir because it's supposed to be completely clear by the time that the beer ends up in the bottle.
I mean, technically, just filtering the beer is going to change the character of the beer, actually.
Correct. I mean, it's going to take out things. It's going to take out proteins. And, you're a long way away from the manual brewing of the past when you do use such techniques. And again, this isn't about these techniques damaging the beer or making the beer worse. It's just that this is somewhat deceptive, that the German beer drinkers mostly believe that, only the natural ingredients are used, and they're not aware of how the filtration techniques change the character of beer, because in the end, what they see on the bottle, what they see on the label is Reinheitsgebot, and brewed according to the Reinheitsgebot of 1516. So there's a little bit of a marketing play that's used to deceive the German beer drinker. And these techniques, they don't have to be put on the labeling. So on the label, you will see water, barley, malt, hops, and yeast. But the brewers aren't required to put any of the other additives onto the labels themselves.
Interesting. What about other you know, techniques have evolved pretty rapidly over the last 20 years. What about other things like pH adjustment or I'm sure there's other findings you could use?
Yes. So the laws themselves have been updated as, you know, technology improved in the 20th century. And it's worth pointing out here that I think the brewing academies in Germany still produce some of the best brewers in the world. We have a lot of brewers coming from the US, from Canada, from all around Europe, from South America now as well, to the brewing academies. And the technical brewing expertise in Germany is probably second to none, you know, in terms of engineering, in terms of the education that's given here. So German brewers have been aware of the modernized techniques and have been applying them in their breweries, and the laws have been updated to reflect this. And again, there's nothing wrong with it as long as you're honest about it. But as we mentioned, mechanical filtration, we mentioned PVPP, pressure fermentation is allowed. You know, if you want to make beer in vast quantities, pressure fermentation is allowed. Dilution post fermentation is not allowed, on the other hand. So once the beer, the final gravity has been taken, the law says that you're not allowed to dilute the beer. So you can't make high gravity beers and then dilute them.
And you can't, I assume you can't blend beers either then? Is that true?
You can blend FOB malts, so colored malts, to make a darker beer out of a light beer. But you can't blend beers and call a beer a new beer style. So the rules of blending aren't as restrictive. On one side, you can blend a dark and color, as long as the color is extracted via brewing techniques to make a dark colored beer. But you can also make a Radler, so you can mix lemonade and beer as long as you don't call it a beer. But not for styles. German brewers don't blend different beers to make new styles as such. In terms of pH, then, pH adjustment, you are allowed to use lactic acid for dropping the pH level in the mash tun. The lactic acid does need to be naturally derived, though.
So it would be derived from malt, I would assume? Or?
So it will be derived from malt, that's correct. And this is mainly to satisfy the Rheinitzburg, particularly in Bavaria. So the purity law is controlled at each state level. So there's 16 states in Germany, and it's most restrictive in Bavaria still, where they don't really want to have anything seen as a chemical put into the mash tun. So the lactic acid is derived from malt and is then, you know, poured into the mash tun for adjusting the pH. And I've worked together with Bavarian brewers, and I've brewed beer down in Bavaria. And when they do this, they become a little bit ashamed that they're kind of cheating a little bit. And I ask them about it, why it's not more public. And they say, look, they don't really want the beer drinkers to know about this. It is naturally derived, but they prefer the beer drinkers themselves not know. And they say, you know, as a home brewery, can do this with acidulated malt, which is true. But, you know, in the end, the lactic acid is chemically the same. I don't see any reasons for going to extra lengths to, you know, produce this via malt, just so that you can get around historic laws that really weren't continuous to begin with.
What about something like a rye beer, which is traditionally a German beer, I believe, right?
That's correct. Yes. So if you're brewing a bottom fermented beer, you can't make a lager beer with rye. So you're still restricted to using 100% barley malt for a rye beer. If you are making one, you can use top fermentation and use rye malt to make the beer. So a brewer here in Berlin, for example, he makes his Imperial Stout with quite a large amount of rye malt, and there's no problem there. But if you're making a bottom fermented beer, you would be restricted from using rye malt.
Interesting. Well, due to EU rules, I believe that beers that are imported into Germany aren't actually subject to the purity law, which is an interesting twist. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is really interesting. In Germany, the laws only apply to beers brewed by German brewers and sold as beer in Germany. So if you're brewing a beer in Dublin, for example, the Guinness Brewery in Dublin, you can export that beer into Germany, and you can sell this as beer in Germany. So the EU stepped in here in 1987. And basically said that Germans had a monopoly over their beer drinking culture, beer culture. Since 1987, it is possible for brewers outside of Germany to sell their beer as beer in Germany without the laws applying. Likewise,
they can make pretty much anything, right? I mean, they could brew anything.
You can brew anything. So, roasted malt, for example, is fine. You can use isinglass for filtering. The Belgian brewers can add cherries to their small percentages of beer that, you know, for Creek, Lambic. The brewers that are making stronger, higher gravity beers, such as Triple, Belgian Triple, will add 15-20% sugar and can get away with selling that as beer in Germany. So that's not a problem. Interestingly, German brewers can also get around the laws or ignore the laws completely for their export beers. So larger German brewers have been known to sidestep the rules and make beers, particularly for export. And sell them on the international market as beer, even though they wouldn't be able to sell them in Germany as beer. So this is kind of embarrassing for those brewers that have been caught out. Because it shows double standards, you know? So it only applies to German brewers making beer to be sold as beer in Germany. But that's kind of the way the German brewing industry, particularly for the larger brewers, that's the way they like it. They like the walls to be up, you know, around the industry. And they're not interested in taking these walls down for imported beers, allowing more freedom internally, because the beer styles that are being sold today are largely the ones that these rules apply to. There was an interesting case for Guinness. So I just wanted to touch on an interesting case for Guinness when they were challenged about 10, 15 years ago about the use of roast barley and the German purity law. So Guinness draft uses roast barley, you know, to give you this roast quality in the beer, a certain amount of bitterness and dryness in the beer.
It hasn't been malted is the key point, right?
It hasn't been malted. And because this is roast barley, it's not allowed to be used even for top fermenting beer in Germany. So Guinness couldn't open a brewery in Germany today in 2017 and use roast barley. And even though it's a top fermented beer, sell this as beer in Germany today. But when they were challenged online about, you know, whether this applies to the Rheinalzgebirge or not, the head of marketing who came online and made a post, he phrased it very interesting. He said, no, our beers do meet the standards of the 1516 Rheinalzgebirge, and we only use the natural ingredients, water, hops, and barley in our beer. And that was the perfect response. You know, he didn't have to go into the details about roast barley and whether roast barley is malted barley. And that's what the beer drinkers in the end are interested in. They want to know if it's natural or not. You know, if they want to know if they're being cheated or if they're chemicals. It's not about the, how long the grains were malted for, or whether, you know, the degree of roasting, means it's malted or not. They're just interested in the pure natural ingredients, and they don't really care about roast barley as a small amount of the grain bill in an Irish stout.
I mean, doesn't the fact that an imported beer can potentially contain anything put the domestic producers at somewhat of a disadvantage?
I think it does to a certain extent. I mean, there are ways.
Because there's a whole bunch of styles, for example, you can't brew.
Yeah, that's true. But in Germany, the beer market for these beer styles is very, very small. So the German beer drinkers aren't really interested in Belgian triples. They're not really interested in Braggots. Even if you look at the beer styles for where the rules have to get exceptions, for example, with the Gose or with the Berliner Weisse, the German beer drinkers aren't really interested. In the north, 2/3 of Germany, it's 95% pils is consumed. In the south, Hefeweizen is the majority now since the 1960s. But Germans predominantly are interested in German beer styles, so German pils and Hefeweizen. Occasionally, they will be interested in the Bock at different times of the year, Bock beer. But they're not really interested in these other beer styles. And as long as the brewing industry tells them, the German beer consumer, that this is the best beer in the world and it has a long tradition, and because of the Rheinalzgebot, it's the best beer in the world and it's guaranteed to be the best beer in the world, they will be skeptical about trying any of these other beer styles. And I think this is one of the problems, is because of the myth and because it has really taken root in the mentality of the German beer drinker, they're less inclined to try something new. So I think there are certain disadvantages for brewers, you know, in that their hands are being tied. But I think the advantages for the brewing industry, just mass producing pils, are far, far away those disadvantages, if you look at Germany as a whole.
Well, I was thinking here in the United States, up until the late 80s, probably even to the early 90s, we started to have this craft beer revolution really in the 90s. And it significantly changed our drinking habits. Obviously, everybody was drinking, Bud Light or Bud or all these other mass produced beers, from World War II all the way up until the late 80s. And nowadays, the craft beer industry has just exploded. We have over 5,000 craft breweries. Can that even happen in Germany? Is it possible?
So I think there are different aspects of this. The craft brewing, we all look towards the US when we see the success that the craft beer industry has had. And, it's been going against the mass-produced Pilsner beers of the times in the 60s and early 70s. I think there was a real need for the brewers to rediscover the European beer styles of, let's say, Britain and Belgium in particular. In Germany, remember there's a longer tradition of brewing, a really rich brewing culture, and I think we shouldn't forget that in this conversation, where I'm quite negative against the Rheinheitsgebot, but the reason is that I'm very positive about Germany's long brewing culture. And in Germany, there are 1,500 breweries. In many of the villages around Germany, you'll have beer that's brewed locally and it's consumed locally, and the brewers will be brewing the same beer style that their families have been brewing, and often the breweries handed down, between generations, from father to son, from father to daughter now as well, more and more, which is nice to see. And they're brewing the beer styles, and recipes haven't really changed. And they might just brew a Helles and a Dunkles, so a light lager beer and a dark beer, maybe a Hefeweizen as well. And the question is, are these craft beer breweries or not? And that just depends on your definition. I think in many respects they are. But I think variety is now seeping into the cities where people are discovering, let's say, the modern US craft beer style. So let's say the pale ale, IPA, and stout.
IPA is the top selling craft beer style here in the United States. It didn't even exist, 20 years ago for all practical purposes,
Yes, and beer does go through trends. So we are seeing that now, that these new beer styles are being discovered and being brewed by German brewers and international brewers, coming to Germany. So Stone Brewing Company opened up their brewery. They launched it 3 years ago and started brewing last year. So here in Berlin, and we see BrewDog have now opened their bar. So the craft beer is coming to Germany, but at the same time, it's only been a recent phenomenon. So I was in Berlin. I was at the unveiling of the first continuously brewed American pale ale 4 years ago. So before 2013, there wasn't a continuously brewed American style pale ale brewed by a Berlin brewery. And now I would say there are about 20 breweries making American pale ale. So it's pale ale with a strong hop aroma using American hops or Australian hops. So it's slowly happening here now. But you'll see what I call Rory's law of craft brewing, is that countries with the strongest traditional beer culture are actually the slowest to change. So if you look at, for example, the US and Australia, where there was a really poor historical brewing tradition, these were the first to have strong home brewing communities that would then want to brew flavorful beers to have an alternative to the mass-produced pils that was available. But then if you look at Scandinavia, a little bit closer, they were the next wave to take on craft beer. And then lastly, Great Britain and Germany, finally, are the bastions of brewing with these long brewing traditions. And Germany will be the last one to hold out and crumble. So it's slow at the moment. It's in the US, I think it's worth something like 15-20% of the beer market at the moment. In Germany, it's less than 1%. It's very, very slow at the moment. But at the same time, tools like Rate Beer Untapped, people are able to swap their beer experiences with blogs, swap brewing recipes with, for example, Beersmith. So there is a community that's sharing information more and more, sharing knowledge. There are more and more hops in the market, so there's an international community, and it's nice to see that the craft beer. So these new styles are coming to Germany as well. But let's not forget that there are smaller breweries around Germany that have been brewing by hand, that have been brewing traditional styles, such as Hefeweizen, such as different lager styles. And those shouldn't be forgotten. And I would hate for, this new wave and this new interest in beer to forget about these, because I think that's really where the German brewing heritage needs to be protected, is in these smaller breweries. And unfortunately, they are now aligned. They see craft beer styles, so pale ale, IPA, stout, porter. They say these as being challenging to the the German beer tradition. I want these breweries to keep making exactly what they have, using the exact same recipes, the exact same ingredients, you know, as they have been doing, that they keep these traditions alive. But they see themselves now as being challenged by new beer styles, and they're aligning themselves, unfortunately, with the bigger mass-produced you know, pils, German pils that are being brewed by big industrial breweries around Germany. So what we see in Germany today is largely what you saw in the US in the 1960s, is that, you know, commercial in big, large industrial brewers have taken a lot of the flavor out of beer, and because they've been competing mainly on price. So in Berlin today, most people will drink pils, and a lot of people will buy the pils that they know, or they buy the pils that is the cheapest. And you can get a half liter of pils for as little as 28 euro cents. So that's 30 US cents in your supermarket.
Yeah, I've been to Germany a couple times. It was pretty astounding to me that the beer is basically cheaper than soda or water, which is not the case at all here.
Correct, yes. So beer has become a commodity, and if your beer is a commodity, you know, you want to protect that. You don't want anyone else to come in. And they're competing mainly on price. And that's why this Reinheitsgebot is being protected and celebrated, is that the beer sales themselves have actually dropped for 10 years in a row in Germany. So if you look at the pills, for example, it has dropped. The numbers have been doctored in the last couple of years because they've included non-alcoholic beer and then Biermischgetränke, so beers mixed with fruit juices and lemonade.
But beer, I mean, but consumption in Germany is still one of the largest in the world, one of the highest in the world, isn't it, for beer?
It's quite high overall, but it's dropping. So young people aren't drinking beer anymore. They're not interested in drinking the beer brand that their fathers drank. So they're moving slowly and slowly to, they're moving over to cider, for example, is now growing quickly. Cocktails in the cities, spirits, you know, gin and whiskey are coming in as well. And beer consumption itself has dropped continuously for the last 10 years.
So, I mean, if they're competing on price, as you mentioned, is that really affect a lot of the smaller brewers? I would imagine that's a huge disadvantage for as you mentioned, the small family-owned brewers or craft brewers that even brew traditional German beers, right?
It is to a certain extent, but not like what you see happening, for example, at the moment in the craft beer industry. I mean, there isn't any kind of consolidation going on there. In Germany, there are basically two sizes of breweries. There's the large national breweries that, you know, can distribute amongst the 16 states. And then there are the small family-owned breweries. And there's a huge gap between these two. There are very few medium-sized breweries in between. And the small breweries continue to make beer. You know, they're not expanding. They're just making the beer that's sold locally. And the large breweries are making pils, for the most part, as cheaply as possible. Now, there are some exceptions. For example, if you take wheat beer brewing, if you look at what Schneider is doing, Schneider brewing in Bavaria, or Weinstefana, they're making world-class beers. I mean, they're not compromising in any way. But if you look in the north, a lot of the Pilsburys are competing. They're not trying to take on, they're not trying to buy up the smaller breweries that just don't have any established brands. It's not really of interest to them. They've almost given up on the German beer market. So for the large German breweries, what they're looking at is the export market. So they're looking at, for example, China and India, where they're looking for some authentic product. You know, and it's difficult to have something more authentic than a 500-year-old beer law that guarantees the best beer in the world. So this is why the myth is being propagated. You know, the market isn't the German market, it's the export market. And German brewers need to continue the myth so that they can sell something special that no other, you know, country can produce.
Well, and I have to say the techniques and the equipment, and you know, I've been to Germany, and it's just astounding. Some of the brewing equipment I've seen from Germany is just, you know, really probably the best in the world, I think.
That's correct. I mean, if you see, the smaller breweries are still using breweries that have been around for 100, 120 years. You know, these things were built to specifications, high quality, are still being used in the smaller breweries. The larger breweries, you know, are able to build up, and they have some of the best brewing equipment manufacturers in the world. I was recently in South Africa, and I saw there's in Cape Town, there's a real explosion, a new interest in medium-sized brewery. So I was at a 30 hectoliter system. They're all investing the money in the Rolls Royces of the beer world or the brewing equipment world. So they're not afraid to spend the money, and they go straight to Germany for the equipment and also to German brewers. So I think four of the breweries in Cape Town have young German brewmasters there, because the brewing expertise is also highly respected of the German trained brewers.
Now, obviously, the German Brewers Association is a staunch defender of the law, the purity law. And from what I understand, they actually tried to get a UNESCO World Heritage status back in 2014, which I don't fully understand, but maybe you can explain that to us.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So UNESCO is the body of the UN that is working to protect, you know, the culture and traditions. Particularly since 2005, they've been taking on a non-tangible heritage. So, rather than monuments and buildings, they want to take on some of the practices, so festivals and dances. And brewing fits within this mandate as well. So in 2013, the German Brewers Association, which is a body that really is at the top of the brewing industry. It oversees the large commercial breweries, but also is the umbrella body for a lot of the regional brewing associations. So all brewers, willingly and unwillingly, seem to end up being a part of the German Brewers Association. But they, in 2013, they started a bid to have the purity law, or the Reinheitsgebot, the document from 1516, so this myth that we just discussed, they wanted to protect this under UNESCO, basically wanted recognition of it as a valuable good for cultural heritage, and that it should be protected so that Germany would have something unique. And by the end of 2014, it became clear that this bid was being rejected. And the reasons given by the committee, by the German member of the committee, were that it seemed to have restrictions, seemed to play too much of a role in the bid, so that restrictions on brewing practices weren't really part of the UNESCO, what they were trying to protect. And also there was a disconnect in modern German brewing from handcrafted beer as it was, you know, historically. So this was the UNESCO basically saying to the German Brewers Association that their bid was rejected because, you know, it's, they were trying to use a restriction to, you know, clear the way for modern industrial brewing to have some kind of a marketing statement. It was interesting because in 2016, so just over a month ago, Belgium applied for their beer culture to be protected, and they succeeded in their bid. So at the end of 2016, only 2 years later, Belgium was accepted, and Belgian beer culture, very specifically, is now protected under UNESCO. And if you look at the UNESCO ruling, they say things like, Belgian beer culture is worth protecting because Belgium has a wonderful brewing culture, beer and food pairings, the Trappist beers, beer education, the variety of styles, 1,500 different beers.
It's like the Disneyland of beers, really.
Exactly. And this is something worth celebrating. So, Belgian beer culture in its different forms, of course, there are commercial breweries there. There are some brewing, low quality pills on a massive scale. But what UNESCO was protecting is the positive contributions of the Belgian brewers and the Belgian beer drinkers and, the communities there sharing home brew recipes. All of this is worth preserving. And this is in direct contrast to what the German Brewers Association was trying to protect. So I believe that if Germany really was interested in protecting its German beer culture, you could protect things like, the Oktoberfest, like the discovery of bottom fermentation techniques, of the bottom fermenting yeast, of Rauchbier, of the brewing styles around Franken, of, the beer drinking vessels, of the Maibock, the different seasonal beers, of Kölsch, of Düsseldorfer Alt, of Gose, of Grätzer. Germany has a really, really wonderful beer culture, and maybe second to none in the world, but none of these things are being celebrated because we're all at the mercy of this engine that's trying to export more beer by propagating a myth.
Well, I would argue, though, that the German purity law is certainly a central piece of German heritage, and certainly the brewing traditions that go back hundreds of years are very central to the German culture.
I do think so, but I think we need to celebrate the authentic brewing heritage, so the actual culture, and celebrate the individual elements. So tell Germans about their brewing culture rather than say that the purity law is responsible for the quality of German beer. Because Germans technically do still brew good beer. Even a lot of the mass-produced beers have I would argue a higher technical quality or fewer flaws than some brewed internationally. But if those are, you know, if beer drinkers want to consume these, then it's because the brewer themselves was responsible for producing a good quality product. What's often forgotten are the regionally brewed beers. So very few Germans are going out of the way to look for a nice Helles. Are nobody's drinking Berliner Weisse. Düsseldorf Alt and Kölsch are drunk.
That was a question I want to ask you. Where, you know, when the purity law was enacted across Germany in 1906, did we lose some traditional beer styles?
No, I think the way the laws have been updated, those have been to protect what was being brewed. So they made sure that, for example, wheat beer brewing, Hefeweizen, Weissbier brewing, was protected, as was Kölsch and Düsseldorfer Alt. So they didn't run any of the beer styles into the ground. You know, wheat beer brewing was a monopoly for 250 years of the last 500 years, which is often forgotten. But that was to do with, you know, how tax laws and how monopolies work in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. The way the modern beer laws are applied, they made sure they didn't want to stop anybody brewing. But there are a few cases that I can give you where the law was challenged. So, for example, one example is the Brandenburg beer war. There was a dark beer that was made with 2% inverted sugar that actually did historically have a recipe that was formulated this way. And the modern beer laws, so from the 1953 beer law, would have stopped them using inverted sugar for this bottom fermented beer style. And this was challenged and later became known as the Brandenburg beer war, where the brewery then was allowed to continue to brew their dark beer. That was one example where you know, historic beer style was blocked because of the modern laws. Another example of where we're seeing it today is in Bavaria. There's a brewing equipment manufacturer called Braukon, and they have a brewery called Kamba Bavaria, and they've tried to brew a milk stout. I mean, they successfully brewed a milk stout and packaged it. They have a wide variety of beers, so they brew, you know, Belgian triples and IPAs and pale ales. And this milk stout was challenged because, as probably many of your viewers and listeners will already know, milk stout contains lactose, which goes against the purity law. And being an unmalted sugar, you could say, they weren't allowed to use this. So Kamba Bavaria was blocked from selling this product as beer. And as often is the case, then the question is, you know, how does the consumer on the street see this? And in this case, it was deemed that any consumer would see the milk stout as beer anyway, so they couldn't even rename it and sell it. So what they did instead was they went across the border and had the beer gypsy brewed in Austria, and then re-imported it, packaged it, and sold it as milk stout again. So there are ways around the law, you know. But it is slowly being challenged by different breweries.
Now, I assume there's no serious legislative attempts to actually get it changed, right?
No, at the moment, it's only individual brewers are tackling it. And here it is worth pointing out that the modern law, so since 1993, it is allowed to have what are called regional or specialty beers brewed. So the law does allow brewers to apply for special beer status. So you could say that something, for example, a Leipziger Gose, which does use some coriander and sometimes salt in the water, that this beer style has six historical significance, and you can apply for an exception, and you need to be granted the exception for that particular beer, but then you can brew that style and you can continue to brew that beer style as an exception. So it does allow for this, but of course this again is playing into the hands of the larger breweries, because as many small breweries do when they're brewing historical beer styles, these are seasonals. They're not, you know, turning over a percentage of their production into this. It's not like they can plan 3-6 months in advance to apply for the exception. I know brewers in Berlin who, you know, formulate their recipes on brew day as they are pouring the ingredients into the mash tun. And for those brewers, they can't apply for the exception for every single, seasonal beer that they're brewing. So this plays into the hands of the large brewers who might want to brew a Goza or occasionally a Belgian triple, as has had occurred, but not for the small brewers who can't apply for an exception every single time.
We have nano breweries here locally that, you know, they brew a different beer every day almost. It's pretty astounding. It's fun though, because you go in there and they've always got something new.
It is, and this kind of freedom, again, for 99% of the beer drinkers in Germany, this won't really be an issue, because at the moment they're interested in pils, and eventually they'll be interested in pale ale, IPA, hopefully stout, and some Belgian stout. And all of these can be brewed according to the law. So in that sense, the law itself isn't restricting them. Very few beer drinkers, I can see for the foreseeable future, are going to be clambering for, you know, beers brewed with heather or braggots, or, you know, beers brewed with juniper. It's the architecture of how this restriction is enforced that is the problem. It's not that, you know, all brewers should be brewing, throw caution to the wind and be throwing everything into their mash tun. It's the fact that it's an artificial badge of quality when it clearly isn't, that I think is the problem here.
So it seems like living in Berlin, you must be fighting an uphill battle. You probably get do you get a lot of hate mail every day?
So in the last year, there's been a lot of discussion about it, and people are blue in the face and tired of talking about it. And, you know, people have become very entrenched. There's the staunch advocates of the Reinheitsgebot in the industry who, you know, they just talk down to you and don't want to engage in any of the details of the conversation. Then there are the angry brewers who, you know, want to have the freedom to brew whatever they like. I'm independent and I'm not associated with any brewery, so I can be a little bit like a gadfly. So I can get a little bit of an argument where other brewers might be a little bit shy. A lot of the brewers themselves will tell me privately how they feel, but they don't want to come out publicly because they're afraid that it might damage their reputation. And at the moment, most German beer drinkers would be in favor of the Reinheitsgebot because they don't really understand the truth behind it. So it is an interesting debate. And being in Berlin, I mean, Berlin was always a kind of rebellious city, and there's an international community here. So it's interesting to see what's happening here at the moment. In Bavaria, in the south, so particularly around Munich or around Bamberg, they're very protective of their brewing heritage, and they think that's synonymous with Reinheitsgebot. So there, I would be less likely to have a public debate. Because I think there it's just worth celebrating what they actually, you know, brew, particularly in Bamberg and the breweries around Bamberg.
You might get tarred and feathered or something, you know.
Yeah, well, I have received hate mail and I have had public spats, particularly via Twitter, with different export managers of large breweries who claim to be independent. And, you know, but if their sales bonuses are dependent on the export market, I think it's pretty clear what side of the argument they're going to be arguing on.
Okay. Well, I'm actually coming up to the end of the timeline here, Rory, but I just wondered if you had a second or two closing thoughts.
Yeah, again, I think the reason we're having this conversation is, of course, the 500-year anniversary, but it's worth pointing out again that Germany has a wonderful brewing tradition, and it is worth coming to. If any of your listeners or viewers have never been to Germany, it is worth coming to Germany.
It's well worth it for the beer, I can attest to that.
Yeah. And they should seek out the small regional breweries, particularly around in Franconia, around the Bamberg area, brewing fantastic beers. You'll get, particularly when beer is fresh, as something like a Helles beer that hasn't been pasteurized. I mean, that's really where the German craft is. Again, German brewers making Hefeweizen, I still think, are the best in the world. My own favorites would be Schneider and Weinstephaner. So this positive contribution to the beer world is worth celebrating. I think for the Reinheitsgebot, we really should look towards removing the legal framework and allowing brewers to be a little bit more creative, but that will take a little bit more time. So for me, the priority at the moment is just educating Germans on their own positive beer culture. And then finally, the German Brewers Association is only really representing the larger breweries, even though they claim to be representing all aspects of German brewing culture. And I just think the German brewing tradition and German brewing heritage is in the wrong hands there. And that for UNESCO, for example, another bid should be made that celebrates the positive aspects of German brewing. But let's not forget in Germany as well, since I'm based in Berlin, that we shouldn't keep these walls up, that the German beer drinkers should also be encouraged to try other beer styles like British beer styles and Belgian beer styles, and that ultimately variety is the spice of life, and it becomes more interesting when, you know, there's variety is available in Germany too.
Well, Rory, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Rory Lawton. He's joining us today from Berlin. Rory is a writer in Berlin, working to challenge the status of German purity laws. Certainly an uphill battle, but good luck with that. Thanks, Rory. Well, a big thank you to Rory Lawton for joining me this week from Berlin. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue is packed with great information for homebrewers and craft beer fans. Take advantage of their fantastic sale and get a one-year subscription now for only $19.99 at beerandbrewing.com. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the Beersmith Cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith Software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers. It lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial today from Beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.